Monster House presents.
The team and I are miles from civilization, in the dense forest of the Amazon, searching for the fabled Mapinguari. After meeting with witnesses who consistently told us of an ape-like creature that knocks and howls, we're convinced that what we're dealing with is something akin to a Bigfoot, so we're treating it as such. And it seems as though we finally got something knocking back at us.
Hey, knock, knock, knock. Turn up the light, turn up the light.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland. It's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
In that introduction audio, we heard a clip from the show Finding Bigfoot, where they went down to South America to look for a creature of folklore, myth, and legend, and even modern sightings, the Mapinguari. We talk a lot about cultural filters on Monster Talk. The show Finding Bigfoot was about looking for giant, hairy humanoids. But stories of the Mapinguari have a lot more detail than that. Let's see how well these legends track with Bigfoot lore. The creature's said to be massive and gigantic, maybe even 2 meters tall.
Check.
It's supposed to be hairy.
Check.
It's supposed to have a nasty odor.
Check.
It's supposed to be a cyclops.
What?
It's supposed to have backwards facing feet.
No, what?
It's supposed to have a huge mouth on its belly that it can use to eat prey.
Do what now?
Do you see what's happened here? The people who want Mapinguari to be a Bigfoot are necessarily ignoring the clearly implausible folkloric elements of the creature. Take the backwards facing feet. Why would that detail be important? Let's look at a few other creatures that have that same trait. The Curupira is another Brazilian folklore creature. It has short red hair, it's a humanoid, and it has backwards facing feet. The Churel of Indian folklore and her male analog, the ghostly Bahut, also have backwards facing feet. In the Dominican Republic, La Ciguapa lurks like a succubus in the forest, making men disappear without a trace. And guess what? She too has backwards facing feet. Why? Because in places where tracking down a monster means reading its trackway, nothing would confound a pursuer quite like having the footprints point opposite to the direction of actual travel. So these backwards feet are found in monster lore all over the world, but in particular in monsters which are purely creatures of myth and legend. When the Bigfooters ignore the feature, they're making a kind of euhemerist fallacy. I keep bringing up euhemerism, which is the belief that at the core of every legend there might be some grain of truth, some reality. Because euhemerism has a serious impact on how cryptozoology works. And not just cryptozoology. There's a serious filter issue when UFO reporters collect and share all the data around where people saw lights in the sky or creatures on the ground, but when the investigators choose not to report that they were also given angelic messages or other decidedly unphysical aspects of the sighting. But let's not go too far down that rabbit hole. If that was even a rabbit, it could have been a hare. And you know where hares usually lead us. Simply put, Mapinguari are not Bigfoot. Slapping the Bigfoot label on one really does require a lot of special pleading and blatantly ignoring many aspects of the legends. But Bigfoot is not the only creature that people have tried to use to identify the Mapinguari. Since the 1990s, one relentless ornithologist has been trying to prove that the Mapinguari is actually a living, giant ground sloth. Let's listen to a clip from the TV show Sightings, where David C. Oren's theory is discussed.
It had a large and thick tail was covered with reddish and blackish hairs, had long claws, a monkey-like face. The fellow was absolutely terrified. Couldn't imagine what he'd seen.
Dr. David Orlin is a Harvard-educated research biologist working in South America. He believes that ancient legends about a creature called Mapengwe may be based in fact.
Two separate places, people were sent running away from what they considered to be this animal. Reports of this thing from all the far corners of the Brazilian Amazon, Venezuela, the Guyanas, Colombia, Peru, Bolivia.
Dr. Orem has talked to many people who describe the Mapengwe as a creature who walks with backward feet. It stands over 6 feet tall, weighs more than 500 pounds, and according to one hunter, it is impervious to repeated blasts from a shotgun.
Consistently, people report that this creature has a very, very bad smell, and then it affects the nervous system. People describe themselves as being disoriented, intoxicated, and there are three separate cases in which people are stated to have become mute for the rest of their lives after getting a large dose of this. Many of the people who give you these first-hand accounts, is they'll say, I didn't believe in this thing either. I thought it was just a legend too, until I saw it. And let me tell you, it's not just a legend. There is a horrible animal out there. They're terrified of this animal.
Although Dr. Orem has not seen the creature for himself, 10 years of data collected in the field have led him to believe the Mapengwe may be a prehistoric creature thought to be extinct.
Suddenly a light went off in my head. I said, my God, this could only be a ground sloth. Well, this is perfectly extraordinary.
Before we dive in with our guest, I've got something else I'd like to mention. It has been 10 years, a real and actual decade, since we started Monster Talk. July 2nd, 2009 was when our first episode was posted. It was really episode 4 about the Loch Ness Monster and plesiosaurs featuring Dr. Adam Stewart Smith that, for me, really defined what I wanted to do with the show and gave me my elevator pitch. I've used this pitch for a decade to explain the show to people in a hurry.
You know how on TV shows about monsters, they always have the stories and the weirdness take up about 95% of the time, and then occasionally throw in a tiny little nod to skepticism and science? Monster Talk is the inverse of that. We have a tiny portion devoted to the monster stories, and then use the rest of that time to talk about science and critical thinking. Like the Loch Ness Monster, there's no good evidence for a plesiosaur in the lake, despite all the blurry photos. But what can science actually tell us about these prehistoric animals? We brought on a paleontologist who specialized in plesiosaurs to share all kinds of wild info about these animals. Did you know they gave birth in the water, even though they were reptiles? Did you know that they ate stones to help them digest their food, just like birds? Well, I didn't either, but that's the kind of stuff we do on the show.
Which brings me to this episode. I wanted to get old school and do the same thing with the Mapinguari that we did with the Loch Ness Monster. For the same reasons that the Mapinguari doesn't match up well with Bigfoot, I also think it doesn't really match well to a giant sloth. But my ignorance of these prehistoric creatures is as vast as the pampas of Argentina. Following the method which has served us well since the beginning of the show, I went to scientific journals and looked at giant sloth articles until I found an expert whose research has been cited numerous times and had extensive experience with this topic. I reached out to Dr. Richard Farinha, and he graciously agreed to share some of this knowledge with our audience, and there is a lot of it. One more thing. We have a big announcement about Monster Talk's future that we're quite excited about, so please stay tuned after the interview. But for now, let's get down to South America for some
Monster Talk.
I'd love you to introduce yourself. When I was looking for information about giant sloths, your name came up on so many research papers. So you were the number one person I wanted to reach out to.
Okay, I hope I live up to the task. My name is Richard Farinha. There's a squiggle above the N, this fancy letter of ours in Spanish called Ñ. It's not Farina, it's Farinha. I'm 61. I'm a paleontologist, of course. I live in Uruguay. What else? I like cooking. I like playing football. I like many things, and of course, I love ground sloths with all my heart.
That's fantastic. Did I also read you're making movies?
Well, yes, some videos, some documentaries. I filmed with some friends about paleontology, most of them, but also about biomechanics of penalty kick in men's football. Game that in United States you call soccer.
That's right.
I got the prejudice that I call football that game in which the ball is played with the feet.
Yeah. I asked you on to talk about the Mapinguari and some of the legends about it. An ornithologist named David Oren had claimed that he thought that maybe the legend of the Mapinguari was really talking about a giant ground sloth and maybe one that was still alive today.
Well.
You know, that seems very, very unlikely. But what I realized was, while we may not be able to find a living ground sloth, we should talk about what we know about them, what science has found. And since you're one of the people who's done a lot of really interesting work in this animal's research, I thought it would be good to talk to you.
That's great. About the Mapinguari, what I want to say is only that, skeptical as I am, I would love with all my heart, I'm wrong.
That's how I feel about Bigfoot.
Yes, absolutely.
So what can
by the
you
way,
tell us?
Sorry. By the way, Mapinguari is a carnivore, which may a story that may come again as a subject as we continue talking.
Yes. It's one of my questions to talk about the what these animals ate, and I saw that you had written about that some. That's very interesting. So let's talk about them in general. What are giant sloths, Megatherium and the Megatherids? What were these animals and what did they look like?
Well, we are more familiar with living species that are very small, about 3, 4, 5 kilos in size, and they live hanging from the upper branches of the trees in the tropical forest in South and Central America. While many of the fossil relatives are far too big to live on trees, they were, some of them, were about the size of an elephant, 4 or 5 tons. So no tree would have been able to support them, of course.
I'm so interested in megafauna. For them to be that large, I just looking at their skeletons, they must have had enormous bellies. Let's don't go to the food yet.
Yes.
I'm so interested in all these aspects. Do we know how fast they were, or is there any way to tell that? Do we have any trackways or anything?
There are. Yes, there are a few trackways, but usually you don't run. You usually walk. It's the usual pace, the usual gait for an animal. You seldom run. You only run in exceptional locations when you have to run for your life. Or if you eat living things and fast things, you have to run after your food and eventually, of course, for your life as well, because you have to feed yourself and your younglings. But the trackways, I know a few of them. I've seen that of Megatherium, which were very impressive in the southern part of Buenos Aires province in Argentina, a few hundred kilometers from where I live. Very impressive, very big things, 90 centimeters, which is about 3 feet in length and 45 centimeters wide and 20 centimeters deep. Very, very large feet. They had, and they were assigned, of course, to the largest of them all, which is Megatherium. But there are others, and very interesting. In North America, they found that people were chasing a sloth, which is a very dramatical story told by the tracks. And there are some others, but you don't see them running. Now, if you have a look at the scars, the muscle left on the bones, you must conclude they were very muscular and they possibly move as fast as modern big animals, which are not very fast compared to medium-sized horses, let's say. But of course, they wouldn't deserve the name of sloth. They weren't so slothful. I mean, the fossil relatives.
Yeah.
Yes, compared to the modern species.
And what kind of a geographic range are we talking about? How much of the Americas did they inhabit?
They were their origin is found in the southern part of South America, in Patagonia. And little by little, along the million years went by, they reached other parts of South America, also Central America, North America, and the Caribbean islands. And that's a fine story as well. One of the modern species, Bradypus, it seems to be the sister group of all the rest of sloths, while Colypus, the other species, might have may have descended from a branch of the group that colonized North America first and the Antilles, then and enter South and Central America from the islands. And being so distantly related, it is amazing they have the same habits. They live upside down. They are very slow. They chew very slowly their food. They live in the highest branches. It is amazing. It seems that after the big extinction, which I hope we'll talk later, the only way you can be a sloth is being small and living upside down in the highest branches of tropical trees.
Wow. I think I saw on a David Attenborough documentary a long time ago that the sloths tended to leave their scat in one place, but that might
Yes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But I wouldn't imagine that would be true for ground sloths.
I don't think so, but of course we have little evidence, if at all.
Oh. Yeah, that would be, you would also know more about what they ate when you have scat to look at, I guess. Or in this case, I guess it would be coprolites, is that right? I think so.
There are a few in the coprolites, the feces, the fossil feces. I know better are those left by Mylodon, Mylodon, in a cave in southern Chile, in a very cold environment, very cold nowadays, even colder possibly. During the ice age, when it lived, and precisely the cold was enough to preserve the hide of the animal and the feces, and so the food the animal ate could be identified by the remains, the plant remains in those feces.
Oh, this is the mummified sloth.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, I saw that on a documentary. I like to watch documentaries.
Of course.
I saw
part of the hide yesterday. You know, I was in La Plata yesterday, and we had a meeting, and I couldn't stop standing in front of it once again for the millionth time and admire the possibility that such an unlikely remain was preserved.
Yeah, it's so interesting. If I remember correctly, when it was found, they thought it might have been a relatively recent death, but it was actually quite a bit more back.
Mylodon was thought to be alive, so it was wanted, dead or alive, you know. It was a very interesting story back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, over one century ago.
Yeah, and I think that one's named after Darwin as well, right? Myledon Darwini, I think.
Yes. But this was considered a different species because it was alive. It was possibly alive. It was even named as a different species. But eventually they realized that was only a dream, just like the Mapinguari.
Yeah, I think there was also one sloth found mummified in maybe New Mexico.
In North America as well, yes.
Yeah. The Shasta ground sloth.
Shasta ground sloth, yes. Nothrotherium shastensis.
Yeah. I'll put a link to some of these in our show notes so listeners can go see the sort of conditions where these were found. It's very interesting. So they had quite a big range, and they lived for a pretty broad amount of time, and I guess some of them, I mean, the small ones, the small sloths. So as far as how these things are related, we've talked about this a few times on the show. There's these sort of comparative anatomy that's used in geological records, and also now DNA and molecular analysis to kind of determine, you know, how these different species are connected to each other. Where does the giant sloth, how is it related to the sloths that are alive today?
One of them, Bradypus, is very distantly related to all the others. It seems a branch or a group that lived in South America for the last 30-something million years, while the other, Colypus, was that one that I mentioned that must have derived from animals that colonized North America first, the Antillean, then, and even then from the Antillean, they colonized South America and Central America.
So have we, or has anyone done the, like, mapping the genome?
Well, actually, there's only a few of this, the species of the fossil extinct sloth that whose DNA was found. DNA can be found only up to now, at least, in fossils that are not too old, only a few thousand or tens or thousand years. And the group, of course, has a much longer history of 30-something million years. So most of the sloths, we can surmise their position in the phylogenetic tree by studying their anatomy, their morphology, like in the old day.
Sure, yeah. I guess let's talk a little bit about their food. What did their dentition look? What did their teeth look like? What do we know about their stomach contents? That sort of thing. I guess we only have a few samples of that.
Very little. Mostly, we paleontologists love teeth. You know, teeth are made of a very hard tissue, so they are very well preserved, and they've got plenty of information about the diet of extinct animals once you compare their form with modern species. Now, Xenarthrans lack enamel, so this is a difficulty, and also they are very weird. Their morphology is very special, very peculiar, and in many ways you can't identify the same features as in modern animals you study. I mean, cows, horses on the one hand, and dogs and cats on the other. So in many ways we are still trying to figure out the way they chew, the food they ate. Most of them are traditionally recognized, identified as herbivores, But there was a crazy South American paleontology that proposed that at least one of the species could have been a bit more, could have had a more varied diet than previously supposed. And that guy is talking right now.
Let's talk about that. I read your the paper. You had two papers that I thought were really interesting. They may have been controversial for you. I don't know.
Well, science is about controversy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
If it's not controversial, it is just another piece of knowledge. There are scientists of all sorts, and all of us are important in the way that we contribute with our effort, enthusiasm, and knowledge to building the tree of life as we know it. So you need someone who invents fire, and you need someone to is near the fire when the other goes away to invent something else. But of course, I like being controversial more than other scientists, and it's just a preference, a personal preference with nothing special in it. And well, yes, but that led me to propose that megatherium, based on thermodynamical aspects of the ecology of that megafauna, and on some morphological features of that animal as well, that could have been more carnivore, more animalivorous than previously thought.
Yeah, so specifically, I believe you talked about the possibility that the megatherium could have flipped over glyptodonts, those giant armored herbivores that look kind of like armadillos, right?
And yes, of course. Glyptodonts are relatives, actually. They are xenarthrans as well. This group that includes nowadays armadillos, anteaters, and tree sloths, as fossils, ground sloths, and glyptodonts.
The armadillos are very interesting to me because they're sort of an invasive species into my home state. When I was a child, we never saw them. And now they're kind of competing. I think they must be in the same sort of ecological niche as the opossum, because they seem to have the same habitat, and they of course neither of them fare very well on the roads. That's where I see them. But
yeah, so, yeah.
But the glyptodont was enormous, and it must have been very delicious, because it doesn't seem like you would need to build that much armor if you tasted bad, right?
Very possibly, yes. I'm sorry I'm not old enough to have tasted them. What we studied is that, on the one hand, there were too many herbivore species for the grass that might have been present during the Ice Age in the region where here in Uruguay, Buenos Aires province in Argentina, southern Brazil, in this region that the megafauna was at its highest splendor. And the environment must have been a bit colder and somewhat drier than today, and therefore it is the productivity, the grass, the available grass must have been much less than nowadays. And despite of that, there were many, many, many species of giant animals, up to 12 sometimes, not in the region, but in the same site, you find up to 12 giant species weighing over 1 ton.
Wow.
This is weird. And again, it seems there were too few carnivores to be fed with this impressive amount of meat that was available under the form of the mega herbivores. So I made some calculations, and it wasn't unlikely that one of the previously thought as quiet herbivores, quiet vegetarians, let's say, could have had more aggressive habits and must have taken advantage of this resource that was available, meat. It is like in these detective stories, you know, in Poirot's and Agatha Christie's, you have to identify the murderer. I imagine Poirot saying to the glyptodon, "It was you," with French accent. But the glyptodon was too stupid to be a hunter, you know. Must have answered, me. So because the brain of the glyptodon is the size of the brain of a big dog. And it was an animal that could have weighed up to 2 tons. So you need more brain to hunt that what's needed for selecting a patch of grass. And I must emphasize, because there might be many vegetarians hearing this program, that this is valid for species, not for preferences inside one species, in this case, Homo sapiens. So I'm not insulting vegetarians, human vegetarians.
Well, but you have, there's lots of animals that most people think of as being vegetarian that will use opportunities to eat meat.
Absolutely. Oh, no, that's a fact. There's a nice paper by some Chilean authors called Why Animals Eat What They Should Not. And, well, this is valid for many humans as well. But, yes, given the chance, all of us can eat something richer in protein. Even anteaters, which lack teeth, they are described to lick meat, and the description says that they do that with great relish. And I'm quoting.
That's I guess they're getting some nutrition out of it. I'm sure it's not just the flavor. But the let's talk about the physical properties that might support this hypothesis. The first thing I think about is the incredible claws on the Megatherium.
Yeah, like knives. Some of them are, you know, like daggers, about 20 centimeters. You make the math and tell your audience how many inches are those, say 7 inches or something long and flattened. Laterally, the form of a knife, the form of something you want to use to penetrate tissues, to make an aggressive use of that. And this is complemented by the anatomy of the forearm, which they had a very short olecranon process. I mean, the elbow, where the tricep muscles that is useful for stretching your forearm, you know, it is very short, which is more related to speed in that movement than it is related to force. Let me explain. Armadillos that dig, they've got a very long olecranon process. Some of them, even it is longer than the rest of the forearm, which makes up a very strong lever for the muscles. It is like in your car, this is the first gear. If you've got a manual car, of course, not an automatic one. And the anatomy of Megatherium's forearm is that of something designed to move very fast. So you tell me what a fast knife is useful for.
Right. I mean, it could be defense, but what were their predators?
Well, this is a 4-ton animal. The largest, very well known predator is Smilodon, which is tenfold smaller.
Yeah.
It's not a real threat to the Megatherium. It is unlikely Megatherium were hunted down massively. I mean, of course, in some cases it is of course possible, but as a rule, you you don't try to hunt something that is 10 times bigger than you are.
Right. No, I don't.
Unless you've got firearms, of course.
Right. Well, and those were very rare back then. What?
Very. To say the least.
I guess, what would be your smoking gun, though, speaking of firearms, if you wanted to prove this hypothesis? I mean, assuming you're not going to find it, a tree fell on a megatherium that was eating a glyptodont, what would you be looking for?
I'm skeptical about any scientific issue ever have its smoking definitely solving gun. There are many, many evidence in favor of that, and this is the way we conceive. But in science, you know, hypotheses are not permanent things. They are very ephemeral. What is known today will be considered under a very different light tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, or next week. Even the brightest mind of science, like Sir Isaac Newton, was corrected a few centuries after they had died about the way they conceived the universe. So I don't think there will ever be a smoking gun. There are evidences, there are pieces of evidence in favor of that hypothesis, and others that that are not very well explained by that hypothesis, and this is the way we work in science.
Exactly. I like to say that all scientific fact is provisional, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, yes. Yeah. I like to say they're like little candles you light, and they eventually disappear, but they orient you in your way.
Yeah.
It sounds more poetic in Spanish, you know?
I bet. Sorry. Well,
Spanish is more poetic than English, isn't it?
It sure sounds like it. So, Megatherium, where did they live? Like, I know you've talked a little bit about the sort of climate, but that climate must have changed because they lived for a long, long time geologically. But like, what were there? Do we know where they did they build nests?
Well, Megatherium americanum, the largest species described, lived in the late Pleistocene during the Ice Age that became very popular after the cartoons, the films I love myself, even though many of the things are paleontologically wrong, like the incisors in Sid's mouth, Xenarthrans lac. In scissors, but of course the animal looks very cute the way it was depicted. In the Ice Age here in this part of South America, the consequence was that this water that forms that makes up the ice. Was of course kidnapped from the environment, so the environment was drier, and therefore the forests weren't so widespread as they are today in South America, especially in this region, which is not very forested even today. Naturally, forests in this part of the world are very scarce. They might have lived in open environment in prairies or these sort of things, or you know, very short grass with wide horizons.
Do we know if they were solitary or if they traveled in kind of packs? Mm. Or?
Well, the site we are working on. And some others, some of the species at least, might have had some social behavior, yes, which is normal among large animals, elephants and social, and in Africa it is very well studied among bovids. The smaller antelopes are solitary, while the largest, the buffalo, the African buffalo, are social. They live in big herds. And of course, we always see these documentaries in the African savanna, the wild beast going through the Mara River in very large numbers and being hunted by crocodiles. And I think there must be more National Geographic photographers than wild beast.
That's funny. The Megatherium's eyes, did they have stereo vision, do we think?
Yes, to some extent. This hasn't been properly studied, but some incidental observations we made, the eyes were rather, close to each other, and possibly they had a binocular sight, yes.
Interesting. Have they found any records of their brain? I know that there's been some animals, there's been some interesting things where they found, like a casting of the brain. It gave them a little bit of insight into, something about the cognition.
We studied the brains of some sloths, but not of Megatherium. No, we haven't published that, the digital endocranial. There are some work about that. And it seems they were not as stupid as glyptodonts, let's say.
Well, there's that.
Yeah, that's something.
I was thinking along, sometimes you can tell from the shape of the brain how much, how
and
powerful
the
was the nose, how strong was their sense of smell, that sort of thing. Or how much did they hunt with their nose?
Glyptodons, by the way, glyptodons, which we studied, they must have had a very strong sense of smell, and their cerebella were very big, so the equilibrium must have been very important for them. But in Megatherium, we haven't studied that in that detail. But I take advantage of inviting whoever wants. There are many PhD theses to be written on the megafauna and ground sloth in particular.
That's good. We have a lot of young listeners who are always, asking what they could
please come over. Please
yeah.
come over.
They're such interesting, just amazing looking animals. I always, although I don't know what you would call it, when you go to some museums, they have the dinosaurs seem to be in the same sort of pose no matter what museum you go to. The Megatherium's always pose like it's on its back legs, reared up. Was it a quadruped? I assumed it was a quadruped, but...
Well, the tracks, this trackway has 37 tracks, and most of them are from the hind feet. Only a few are from the forefeet.
Really?
It seems they must have been... now and then they could walk on bipedally, but also quadruped, like gorillas. Gorilla could be a good example, a good source of inspiration of the way they walked.
That is fascinating. I'm just trying to imagine walking through the forest or walking through the plains or grasses and seeing something that big walking on its hind legs. That must have been something.
Must have been something, indeed.
Wow.
I hope they invent the time tunnel soon enough before I die.
Wouldn't that be great? Well, it's funny to me, everybody's dinosaurs, but the mammal megafauna was amazing, and I don't think there's been enough. I mean, there's been some good representation.
I guess we can understand them better because they are mammals. They are more closely related to many animals that live today. The ecology, the environment in which they lived, must have been most similar to some present day biomes or environments or ecosystems, so we can understand them better. Dinosaurs are far away in time. They were very different. The world was much different. During the Mesozoic, there was no ice at sea level in the whole planet. Ah, you wanted climatic change? There you have climatic change.
Yeah, it was quite different.
Quite different.
I wonder what the atmosphere was like too. I think there's so many times in the history of the world when the atmosphere was radically different. I'm thinking about, you know, when you get these huge arthropods, you know. What, a meter long? Well,
along the million years, you see everything. Everything unlikely actually happens.
Yeah.
time given.
Yeah. Evolution will make weird things. It is very strange. Speaking of this will sound random, but going back to glyptodonts, I've always wondered this. Did their anatomy allow them to roll up in a ball the way that armadillos can sort of roll up?
No, not so much. Not the big ones whose skeletons we know well. No, not at all.
I was just wondering, from a defensive perspective, did they just squat down to the ground, or did they fight back? I don't know what they did.
They might have fought back, yes, because some of the species of glyptodons have very long and powerful tails made of bones, covered with bones, and some of them are reconstructed even with spikes on the tip of the tail. And we calculated the energy delivered by one of those blows with the tail, taking into account the amount of muscle involved and so on, and it must have been something devastating. We calculated it was 3,000 joules, which means an object of 30 kilos falling from 10 meters.
Wow.
Must have been something very strong.
You would not want to be hit by that.
you better stay away from that. Yes.
So let's talk about their departure, their extinction. What happened?
At the end of the Pleistocene, many very large species disappeared from nearly everywhere in the world. The only place in which we've got very large giant animals is Africa nowadays, and some places in Asia as well, in India and surrounding regions. All the extinctions are associated very well with the time of human arrival, so we are likely to be blamed for that, our own species, Homo sapiens. Also climatic change, but for instance, in Australia, there was extinction of the megafauna there long before there was a major climatic change at the end of the Pleistocene, and of course, conveniently close to the arrival of human beings in that part of the world. What was lacking here in South America, or is lacking to a great extent, is the direct evidence of megafauna having been hunted by or processed by humans. And we were lucky enough to find a site in which there are strong evidence of human megafauna interactions. It is called Arroyo del Vizcaíno. I might want to write it down later so you can reproduce it in written way.
I've got the Royal Society publishing version of the article. I'll put in the show notes.
We've got a website as well. I like to encourage your audience to visit. It's arroyodelvizcaino.org. So please go there. The website is very cool. It was made by someone who knows a lot, Martin Batallés and Gabriela Costoya. They are web designers, and he, essentially, Martin, wanted to become a paleontologist, and he's working with us. So we are very lucky he joined us in our team. Well, in that site, it is impressive. In the bottom of a lagoon, thousands of giant bones were found during a severe drought in 1997. And since then, we've already collected 1,700 bones, very large bones, and there are thousands and thousands still to be extracted because we don't even know how far the fossiliferous layer goes beneath the more modern sediments. And quite a few of them, 60, 70, we studied, have cut marks that have all the features described in the literature as those done by human beings, by tools. Again, another interesting thing is that the official story goes that humans reached the Americas about 15,000 years ago, and this site is 30,000 as old, 30,000 years old. So it was a big discovery, a big finding, and we were lucky enough to be involved in that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, how has the community responded to your paper? Has there been a lot of pushback on the aging?
Well, as usual, some are skeptical, some are more eager to accept the evidence we give. But, of course, this is science we have to discuss. Actually, something I must emphasize is that the person that criticizes you is your best collaborator, because that person points out at details that you, in your enthusiasm, had overlooked. I got a friend, Gustavo Politis, an Argentinian archaeologist. He's a close friend of mine, and he's very skeptical. So when he comments the weaknesses of our approach, I'm sure he's not doing that because he hates me, because he's my friend. We are very fond of each other. We meet in the summer with our families. So I know he is pointing out at something that hasn't been done in the proper way. So we orient endeavor to such aspects that were possibly overlooked in the wake of our enthusiasm.
So it's not even the critic is a collaborator. It's the critic is an especially important collaborator.
Absolutely, the most important, I'd say. Of course, if this is a person that criticizes your work, if they criticize, say, my hairstyle, well, your audience is fortunate enough not to see me because my hairstyle is a mess. Well, I would say, well, you're right, but that has nothing to do with what we are talking about in terms of science, in terms of interpretation of facts. We find
that's a really great attitude, and also I envy your hair. So,
well, I get involved, but slowly.
So, well, I apparently I'm on the fast track. Something terrible happened.
I see your picture here wearing a hat.
Exactly, I love hats.
That speaks volumes.
I liked hats before, but really? But now they actually help keep me from being sunburned. So that's nice. Okay. So is there anything else about giant sloths that I have failed to ask that you'd like to share with the audience?
Million and million, a lot of things. But I prefer people to be a bit hungry, you know, and that they are enthusiastic enough after we have talked about them for them to look after the to look for more by themselves. Of course, I'm available for further consultations whenever they want. In that website, I told they can communicate with. I'm sorry, that website is in Spanish and English, but the Spanish part is more developed. My fault. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay, but, though. I see it. They could also use Google Translate if they need to.
Yes, sometimes translations are, you know.
Well, there's
different
that.
About what you intended, but anyway, they are very useful. Of course, I wouldn't deny that.
It is a good-looking site, though.
At the webpage, they have the email addresses to write to us if they want. So we try to answer as much as possible all the questions we are made. So we are at the orders of your orders and the orders of your audience.
Well, I'll have both the Spanish and the English versions in the show notes linked.
Okay.
That's fantastic. Well, wow. Thank you so much for talking to us about giant sloths today.
Oh, no, quite on the contrary. I'm grateful. I'm delighted to talk about that. And thank you very much for having thought of me and us in general to talk about ground sloths.
No problem. This has been absolutely great. I've learned so much, and I'm sure the listeners will too. So now we have to ask maybe the most important question.
I know.
What is your favorite monster?
Of course, I have to answer Megatherium. Consider monsters in the back in the 19th century. It was the term to describe those animals, the megafauna. I say that Hereford livestock is what I love most nowadays.
The Hereford?
Yes, I'm a big carnivore myself.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so my grandfather has cattle. So as soon as you said
really?
That, I was like, wait, are you talking about the cows?
yeah, I'm talking about the cows. In the country I live, it's only 3.5 million people in Uruguay, you know? And despite of that, there are 12 million cows.
Wow.
Oh, yes.
That's a lot
and
of cows.
Despite my efforts to diminish that population... They are faring very well, I guess.
How are they? This is a little off topic, but how are they prepared there?
Oh, barbecue, of course. This is the most traditional way.
Yeah. Okay. So
wood fire. Carefully, you pass the cinders under a grill, and they are cooked slowly, and could be very delicious and. I'm a proud cook myself, so when we go to the camp to doing field work, I cook.
Wow!
This is something I don't delegate. You know.
Yeah.
I prepare barbecue every day, even for vegetarians. I prepare vegetables or cheese or whatever, but for others that eat meat, I prepare this Hereford with a lot of care. I proudly state.
That sounds like I know we have listeners who are vegetarians, but that close your ears because that sounds amazing.
You are warmly invited to join us. It's heavy work, you know.
I'm sure. Yeah.
It's a lot of physical exertion, but when you eat, you learn that your prayers have been heard.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This was fascinating.
Oh no, not at all. Thank you.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and you just heard an interview with Dr. Richard Farinha discussing the amazing things scientific researchers have learned about giant ground sloths. Please check out the website of Dr. Farinha's team. I've put a link to that in the show notes. While preparing this show, I was reminded by my daughter Sophia that I was supposed to ask Richard about something she'd run across online. I sent off her question and he replied, so here's that exchange, which I found quite interesting.
I heard on the internet that ground sloths were seed dispersers for avocados, but after they went extinct, that humans are responsible for keeping these plants around. Is that true?
Along their history, ground sloths must have eaten all sorts of things, actually. As you know, I propose that Megatherium could have been an omnivore and must have eaten some amount of flesh. But what your daughter, a very clever person, of course, was discussing is what's called the syndrome of dispersion by mega herbivores. Actually, it was originally proposed for gomphotheres, for proboscideans, but all megafaunal species must have been involved in that. There are, according to the authors, there are some fruits that have lost their dispersers. Instead of having an animal that ate them and which favored the germination after they were dropped, they are now in the way of being extinct in along the years because they lacked that animal. And there are some people that propose that humans must take over and disperse the plants. Actually, the one of the researchers, one of the authors, made the experiment himself, and he ate those seeds, big seeds, several times, if you understand what I mean. And those seeds were more prone to germinate than others that didn't have the same treatment.
That sounds like an uncomfortable way to test a hypothesis, but I have to admire the scientist's dedication. And I appreciate Dr. Farinha giving us the digest version of the story. I can't help but think of all the jokes about papers and passing grades had this been a student project. A link to that paper about seed dispersion by megafauna, including giant sloths, glyptodonts, and gomphotheres, will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. And in case you weren't familiar with them, gomphotheres were giant elephant-like creatures that really reminded me of the behemoth creature in the new Godzilla movie. When I looked it up, I was surprised to find that according to a popular fan site, the creature in the Godzilla movie, King of the Monsters, is actually a giant hairy monster with a mouth in its stomach. I don't recall seeing a mouth in its stomach, but in the novelization of the movie, they explicitly state that this creature is, in fact, the Mapinguari. How about that? I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Monster Talk's been an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. This is our last episode, created in partnership with Skeptic, and we are grateful for their support of the past decade. Monster Talk will continue, and I will be working with Skeptic's webmaster, William Bull, who's been handling all the hard work of getting these episodes out to you since we first partnered up years ago. I especially want to thank William for his labor and for Daniel Loxton for reaching out to us with the idea of partnering in the first place. Thanks to Pat Lindsay, who was always helpful to us at the amazing meeting conferences and who is a delight to work with. And thanks to Michael Shermer for agreeing to the partnership. I was never quite clear as to whether he listened to our show, but he never interfered editorial in any way, and that made it a fantastic way to grow our audience. As a brand, I'm very proud of all of our Monster Talk content. The decision to become independent was difficult, but for a variety of business reasons, necessary. I will be working closely with Skeptic to attempt to transition the feed as smoothly as possible once we've got all the hosting arrangements set up. There could be a short interruption while we get that grunt work done, but just stay tuned. This move will not affect our Patreon feed because Patreon's its own hosting platform. A significant reason for this change is that I'm turning the show into a for-profit business. My main goal for the show has always been, and always will be, to spread critical thinking while also celebrating and giving deep consideration to the thousands of kinds of monsters that people experience, imagine, fear, and believe in. In the near future, we'll be taking on advertisers, and I'm still trying to make some decisions around whether to join into one of the commercial podcast networks who've already reached out to us, or to maintain control of the ads myself to ensure they stay entirely consistent with our show's values. This is an important announcement for our Patreon supporters. The Patreon feed has switched to a monthly tiered model, not per episode. As always, the Patreon feed will be advertisement-free and contain extended cuts of the interviews and no censoring of our language. If you can't stand advertising, our lowest tier is only $1 a month for an ad-free extended length experience. We've set up some cool tiers, and we're working on bringing in merchandise and new branding. And our tiers have cool names like Shadow Person, Squatches, Champs, and more. Hop on over to patreon.com/monstertalk to check that out. But if you want to continue to enjoy the free version of the show, it will still be here for you, and the ads will be for products that we legitimately enjoy. I don't know what those are going to be yet, but I can tell you that I already love things like audiobooks and online training, and hopefully we can find great products that you'll enjoy too. So that's the plan. I hope you'll stick with us through any hiccups as we get the new feed set up. It's going to be the same great content with a small addition of some advertising so that we can fund our ambitious plans. Monster House LLC. Wish us luck. Oh, wait, we're skeptics. We don't wish. Oh, we also don't luck. We work hard and we do our best and we hope that's enough. And I think with your support, it will be. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you, as always, for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Is that true?
Is that true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
Is it?
No, is it? Is it true?
Maybe.